want to see the team have the kind of fight that they had in 2016, even if we shock the world. Shock the world!
We're playing a Mexican team in the next round.
That's what I was about to say.
Howard and forward, Jack Price in goal.
And the Colorado Rapids, the team from the Rockies, have scaled their own mountain tonight. They are MLS Cup winners.
Hello, Rapids fans, and welcome to another episode of Holding the High Line with Rabbi and Red. My name is Matt Pollard. We're recording this on the evening of Tuesday, June 26th. Rabbi Mark Goodman, for the first time in 68 days, we are recording a podcast after a Colorado Rapids victory.
It feels good, man. How does it feel for you?
I'm completely relieved, to be honest. The mood in training, we'll have a segment of Front Field 20 folks was way more upbeat from everyone that I spoke to. It feels like, you know, the proverbial, you know, the team has pushed, has completed their Sisyphean task, and now at this point it's just about turning that into momentum into what will hopefully be a giant boulder rolling down on the rest of the Western Conference in Major League Soccer.
Absolutely. It's lovely to see the team winning. And really, like, you know, I hate to be the guy who agrees with the team and the coach right afterwards, but one of the things that Anthony Husband has been saying for a very long time is, you know, we're better than this, we were unlucky, you know, our luck will turn. When you see, like, Gashi slip passes like you did. I know we're jumping the gun a little, Matt, but when you see Gashi slip passes like you did, when you see Edgar Castillo cut back onto his right foot and then with his weak foot curl one into the top right-hand corner, you're like, holy crap, this team actually is kind of good. They just haven't been good. Do you know what I mean? Like, this was kind of a game where you were like, wow, they're very capable, aren't they? They're not a terrible soccer team.
Yeah, I agree, Mark. You know, we'll talk about that a little bit, but first of all, I guess in the interest of the three listeners we have who were super obsessed with the hotel ceiling art that I had, well, we've got a first tonight as far as a recording, Mark. I am physically in Denver, Colorado, and you are elsewhere. How is the City of Angels? And I know a number of Rapids fans have been contemplating going to the game that we'll be playing at LAFC later on the season. What was your thought of Banc of California Stadium over the weekend?
It's good. I mean, the last 3 days have been like, you know, living the dream vacation. Let's see, Sunday I took my family to Disneyland, with the grandparents and with my sister and my brother-in-law, and so there was 9 of us, which is like, you know, at that point, usually at Disneyland when you have 9 people walking together, it's a family and they're all wearing matching t-shirts, and
yep.
it's like somebody's like an absolute Pixar fanatic, or it's somebody, you know, one person wears like a tuxedo mouse hat and the other person wears a bride mouse hat and they have their anniversary date printed on the back of their hat with the mouse ears and everything. You know, Disneyland's quite the scene. And, you know, I'm a, like you, Matt, I'm a California native. I grew up in LA. I mean, I went to Disneyland for the first time in 1985, something like that, right? My mom, we realize this. My daughter's 5 years old. My mom was born in 1950, and the first time she went to Disneyland was when the park opened in 1955. So my daughter was the same age that my mother was when she first went to the park in 1955, when the rides were basically like Dumbo, Matterhorn, Space Mountain, Pinocchio, and like 5 other rides. And they used to, do you know about the e-tickets? Do you know about this, Matt?
I'm roughly familiar with it, yes.
Yeah, back in the day, it was like an old school carnival. You would go up to the booth and you would pay money and you would get a handful of different types of tickets, A, B, C, D, and E. And, the Matterhorn was an e-ticket ride. So it was like an extra, it was like a dollar itself, right? Whereas the A rides were like, you know, a nickel or something like that, or a dime. I mean, like, yeah, it was fun. So that was Sunday. Saturday night, I went to Banc of California and saw, LAFC, and that was kind of like being at Disneyland also, because it's like an amazing experience. Like they really have, this is my back pass for this week in, at around MLS, but like, it's truly a connoisseur's experience of a stadium, in the sense that, not that it's like all about soccer culture or the soccer is amazing. It is. I mean, their team, you know, is really, really good. But on top of that, it's just a really amazing experience. The food is very good. Matt, one thing that you'll like if and when you come here and get a press pass is that the post-game press conference room is in a room where it's a wall of glass on one side, and the glass wall opens up to basically a velvet rope like bar and restaurant, and the bar and restaurant, like, you can sit in the bar and restaurant and order like $15 mojitos and watch the players come in and get interviewed by the writers and the reporters. And as a writer and a reporter, to have like 100 people stand around while you're sitting across from Laurent Simon, and they like are paying extra for the experience, and you're like, I'm just in the front row with my recorder. It kind of feels really cool. By the way, Rapids fans, by comparison, the press conference room at Dick's Sporting Goods Park has a service elevator right behind it, and you can hear the elevator go up and down every time somebody hits the buttons. It's like, you know, night and day, like, you know. And then on top of that, at the very end of LAFC games, and then I'll shut up and we'll talk about other things, but at the end of LAFC games, there's like a deck in the mezzanine, which is like the second level, and all the suite holders and all the kind of like fancy people of LA go up there, and they play like, you know, Diplo and you know, like electronic music and all sorts of stuff while people are wandering around in beautiful cocktail dresses and drinking fancy beverages. And there's kind of like a laser light show, and they close down the field, and there's like this very LA, I'm sitting on a veranda while the sun sets behind me and I'm drinking a drink, and the game just ended and I didn't watch any of it, but I'm here to be seen kind of vibe. It's super LA and kind of amazing. Last thing I'll say is this, which is totally classic. The people, sitting to our right. So I had my press pass, but then I went and sat with my dad for the game. The people sitting to our right showed up 25 minutes late for the game.
That is so Los Angeles.
And then there was a family, there was a group of four people who came and sat in the row behind us. They showed up in the 50th minute. And I was like, you missed almost all of the soccer game. By the way, the game ended 2-0, and both goals were scored in the first 9 minutes of the soccer game. So, like, they literally missed the whole game. Like, almost literally. Anyways, it's kind of an amazing thing. So, if you are a Rapids fan, I highly recommend coming out for LAFC. There's one thing that's a little bit different, which is, like, I didn't notice any kind of organized tailgate that wasn't kind of corporately run. And so it's not like there's a supporters group to welcome you to their tailgate as an away fan. As far as I know, I could be wrong on that, but like, you know how if you go to C38 and you're a traveling fan, you'll be treated like royalty. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like that here. Granted, I wasn't with the away team, which was Columbus Crew, but like, there wasn't the same kind of, you know, honored guest, you know, MLS family kind of thing. I was treated more as a curiosity than as anything else, which is fine, but, you know, it's tailgate culture is, you're gonna be surprised. Mojito culture and $15 cocktail culture is very good here in LA. Tailgate culture is probably better at Dick's.
Okay, Mark, I guess just one other topic, since we'll be into the quarterfinals by the time we pod next, possibly. Have you been paying attention to the World Cup at all? You know, the last 2 days that we've had with the final group stage games happening simultaneously were pretty crazy. Group B had a fantastic finish. Messi and Argentina, you know, were able to survive after this one. And then now with how the bracket stands, you've got, I believe it's Uruguay taking on Portugal. And then I want to say that it's Argentina. I can't remember who Argentina's playing, but if Portugal and Argentina both win their games, you have a chance for a Messi-Ronaldo quarterfinal. Your thoughts on the World Cup so far and just how it's gone?
I mean, I'm bummed that Iceland's out. You know, I think that was it was a great story. I mean, clearly they didn't have the legs for it. The Messi narrative is really great. You know, that he was frustrated in those first two games, and then he pretty much took the team on his back. And if you haven't seen the highlight of the goal that he scored, I mean, it'll you'll see it for the rest of your life if you're a soccer fan. It'll be enshrined in the Amazing Plays Hall of Fame, the same as Maradona's Hand of God goal and the other goal he scored against England in 1986. You know, some of the great things that you see from Garrincha and Pele, you know, Germany's goal in 2014 by Goetze in whatever, like the 114th minute to win it for them. You know, like, it'll be a goal that you will see, just the him bursting through the line, taking the ball on the inside of his knee, feathering it down to his foot, cleanly bringing it over, taking one step, and then lacing it into the back of the net with his right. I mean, it's poetry in motion. So, truly amazing. And just, you know, the fact that there's more of it. For me, it's been about pacing myself. Like, you know, you can't watch both of the games in the group stage simultaneously. You can, but I'm not capable. So you kind of have to pick your battles. And so for me, it's basically been like, you know, I'm kind of pacing myself through the end of this stage until we get to the quarters and the semis when I'll watch a lot more soccer. So
I'm in a similar position here, Mike. I took all of Sunday off. I had to do a bunch of adulting and other chores around the house. So I didn't watch any of the World Cup games. I didn't watch I didn't watch Portland, Atlanta. I think it was New York City FC, Toronto. I was all soccered out, and I needed a day away from sitting on my couch and just completely losing my mind. You mentioned being sad about Iceland getting eliminated. I'm going to pour one out for all the Peruvian fans. You know, their first World Cup in 34 years, if I'm remembering that correctly. Absolutely fantastic fan base. You could see the emotions when I think Garrido, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, scored that goal and then ultimately, you know, ended up winning their game. You know, they were already eliminated at that point. But for them to really go home with something to feel happy about, I thought was really, really positive. And, you know, with the group extending to, 48 teams, I assume Comebol is going to get enough spots to where we're going to see this group again, you know, a relatively young Peruvian group that I think has a chance to grow, potentially be something else. So I'm really excited to see them. They've been one of the more fun fan bases on that end. But enough of that, enough World Cup stuff, enough being an LAFC podcast. Mark, for the first time since the middle of April, the Colorado Rapids got a win on Saturday night at Dick's Sporting Goods Park. They played Minnesota United FC. Minnesota United came out and were absolutely dominant on the ball, creating chances, throwing crosses in. Miguel Ibarra scores unassisted in the 20th minute after a long ball that saw Darwin Quintero absolutely give Danny Wilson a third-degree burn. Tim Howard gets a piece of the shot that goes between his legs, and it's kind of dribbling. It looks like it's about going to stop on the line. A bunch of players converge towards the ball to try and either clear it off the line or smash it in. Miguel Ibarra wins that foot race and puts the Rapids up. After that, fairly even the rest of the half. In the 50th minute, Edgar Castillo on a really, really good build-up and a switching of the field by Enzo Martinez takes a touch to cut it inside, and with an absolute, I'd call it the right button shot on the Xbox for FIFA, just curling it straight over Brian Rowe to score an absolute golazo. He goes and runs over to the coaching staff. I've got a tidbit on that from Field 20. Rapids, in my opinion, continue to be the better team for the next 15 minutes, but against the run of play, Darwin Quintero sets up Batman and Superman. Miguel Ibarra in the box for a cross to Christian Ramirez. Tim Howard has to come off his line because, again, the Rapids defense gets completely burned, and Ramirez has a completely open goal to basically dribble the ball into the net. In the 74th minute, Joe Mason scores off of a great pass from Skelshengashi. The substitute's getting it done, and then Tony Cruz, eat your heart out. Tommy Smith in the 90th minute plus 7 with a thumping header, maybe possibly off his shoulder, to ultimately score it, winning the Rapids their first game since April 14th against Toronto FC. Miguel Ibarra got a red card in what would I would call MLS Fight Club in the 77th minute. Mark, your general thoughts on this game, and what was your good thing from this match?
Yeah, I thought that the game states of the game set up very interestingly, which is that when Colorado went down 1-0 at the beginning of the game, after Tim Howard kind of got megged, he kind of slowed the ball down with the inside of his thigh, and then nobody could clear it off the line before Ibarra pounded it home. The Rapids at that point then only yielded two more shots for the rest of the next 25 minutes, which is that they possessed the ball, they possessed with purpose, they created chances, and they were dangerous. And then in the second half, they were kind of the better team, it seemed like, through long stretches of the game. The narrative there a little bit also is that Minnesota kind of decided to be a little bit more defensive or cede the ball to them, and it bit them. You know, it really got them, especially when Castillo curled that ball, which is just like you said, like right button on the controller, FIFA finesse, into the upper right-hand corner. And I don't know, you were at the game, so you didn't hear the call on the TV, but he had Richard Fleming had one of those really great calls that he had. He said,
well, I saw the highlights. It was, he scores with the left, he scores with the right, Edgar Castillo, he scores when he wants.
Scores when he wants, he scores when he wants, Edgar Castillo, he scores when he wants. We need to get them doing that over the, it's kind of amazing to have a left back who scores all the time like that. I have seen, by the way, that goal scored upon the Rapids so many times in my, I remember a game a couple years ago where James Riley totally didn't close down his man, and the left attacker put it on his right foot and curled it into the upper right hand corner. I feel like it was against Seattle, but I don't know. I remember. Anyways, the good thing, I guess the really good thing that I would say about this was one of the things I complained about a couple podcasts ago was that in the Rapids 5-man backline attack, they like to bring up a center back, and it exposes them on the counter. In this game, they brought up their center back. One time it was Tommy Smith, and he created a chance that either went for a really good attempt or went for a goal. And another time, Declan Wynn came up, and that's when he fed the ball. I think it was Tommy Smith passed to Enzo Martinez. Or no, who passed to Dom Badgie, who went to Enzo Martinez, who went to Edgar Castillo, that went into the goal. And the other one was the Declan Wynn to Shkelzengashi to Joe Mason for the goal. So, like, the center backs, by coming up the middle, created havoc against Minnesota, and it worked multiple times. And so the good thing was, I'm going to say, you know, live by the sword, die by the sword to some degree. Colorado has used its center back to come up and attack, and sometimes that's exposed them really badly on the back line. And in this game, it helped to contribute, I think, 2 goals in this game, which is kind of amazing. You know, whatever tape all the other coaches in MLS have been watching about the Rapids about how to stop that move and then counterattack and score on them, Adrian Heath put that into effect, and that wound up catastrophically bad for Minnesota.
I agree with you there, Mark. Declan Wynn actually overlapped as well on the Edgar Castillo goal. My good things, I've got a couple of them. First of all, in general, a win, finally getting something, you know, you have to feel positive about it. And I really felt that there was urgency in the final 20 minutes. If you look at the possession stats that you had for the team, not that I want to really focus on any of them, but the Rapids dominated possession throughout the whole of the final 45 minutes, the second half. And then in those final 20 minutes, particularly basically right after Joe Mason and Shkelzengashi subbed in, right after each other. They started, there was a lot more urgency to tie the game up. That led to the Joe Mason goal. And then obviously, you know, maybe a little bit of a beneficiary there, given that Minnesota was playing down a man, and they were also, you know, playing at altitude. So maybe at that point, Minnesota was thinking, okay, we're just going to play for the draw and let Colorado have the ball. But you kind of had all that chaos after the Joe Mason goal that led to 7 minutes of stoppage time that gave the Rapids opportunities. But, you know, it was kind of like the entire team engaged in the Joe Mason, or not the Joe Mason, excuse me, the Dylan Cerna beast mode operation. And, you know, I've talked ad nauseum the last 2 months, basically, that the Rapids have totally been lacking in their, have totally been lacking in urgency and really finishing games strong rather than wilting, especially at home. And it was really, really nice to see them not have that problem, if anything, thrive as their opponent was starting to crumble, and ultimately that leading to results in them getting 3 points. Mark, what was your bad thing from this game?
Tim Howard had 6 saves. One of them was he fell down and got up, the ball hit him in the chest, and it looked like a total accident. Another one was that first ball. It's hard for me to say that, I mean, Darwin Quintero tried to put it through his legs, and it's hard for me to say that Tim really did a bad job, but he didn't do a good job. And one of those things that's really a challenge for this season is a lot of people feel that Tim Howard has lost a step and he's not playing very well. And so if he has a game where you look at him and you say, yeah, that goal was kind of on you and you probably could have done better, it just feeds into this constant negative narrative that our goalkeeper is old and slow and poorly reactive.
Highest paid player on the team by almost $1 million.
I'm not personally of the opinion that Tim Howard is bad, old, slow, and costing the team points to a ridiculous rate. But I lament every moment at which that narrative is reinforced somehow. That's the thing that kind of kills me, which is, I don't know, maybe that's stupid, but that's the way I feel. What's your bad thing?
Again, defensive issues and defensive breakdowns on the counter. If you saw, both goals effectively came off the counterattack in which Minnesota used speed, in cases in which there were even numbers or the Rapids had an advantage defensively. There was a turnover, and I believe it was Jack Price on the first goal who was pressuring the guy who had the ball. I want to say that it was Rasmus Schuler, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, on the first goal. So yeah, Jack Price.
That first ball from Rasmus Schuler to Darwin Quintero is this perfect 40-yard diagonal. It's a thing of beauty, and it's a thing that Jack Price was doing at the beginning of the season. It's like a Jack Price signature ball. And to watch some other dude do it, I was totally jealous.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Rapids are attacking. They're in the ball's in the final third of Minnesota around their goal. Turnover. I don't remember who turned over the ball on the Rapids part, but Rasmus Schuler gets the ball. And as soon as I see that, I'm like, one of the midfielders needs to close him down now before he hits Darwin Quintero. And as soon as he hits that, I see initially the ball kind of curl a little bit. And I'm like, if Danny Wilson just stays level with Darwin Quintero, he should totally be able to manage the situation. And in the time that it took for the ball to actually go into the air and actually land, Darwin, like, as I said, you know, it was Danny Wilson got burned in the sense that he got a third degree burn on that standpoint. And I'm like, okay, Darwin Quintero is going to go up. All Tim Howard has to do is stop that ball and nothing ends up happening. And then Quintero ends up shooting. It goes through his legs. He gets a piece of it. It's like, and I think it was, I can't remember if it was Tommy Smith or it was Declan Wynn was right there. They were kind of already in the net, kind of tracking back with somebody else who was, running in from the middle of the pitch. It's like, all Declan Wynn has to do is clear that. So you had four different sequences of a Rapids player needing to make a play, having an opportunity to make a play. Nobody cut the got the head off the snake, and it ultimately led to a goal. And then similarly, just, you know, as much as I think the defense is starting to improve and doing a little bit more things better offensively, as we talked about with our good thing, Mark, they're still susceptible at the back. They're still prone to mistakes at the back, and the rest of the team in front of them has not been able to adjust their game such to correct for that, effectively leaving them out to dry, and it's leading to goals. And we'll talk about this a little bit in Ask HTL. I'm not sure how the team fixes that, because, you know, as poor as Minnesota has been this season, I think it's pretty clear what the beat on, what the scouting report is when it comes to, we want to get two goals on the Colorado Rapids. And I don't know how they correct that, so to speak. And at some point, you've got to think that, you know, those players are just who they are. You know, how much, you know, how much, you know, Tommy Smith, excuse me, you know, he's played for, going back to his time at the New Zealand national team, you know, he's spent, what, two World Cup cycles now with Anthony Hudson. How much better is the left center back in a 3-5-2 is he going to be? We talked about where Tim Howard is at, and, you know, he's only going to see regression as he continues to age, you know, and he'll be in the last year of his contract in 2019. Not sure how you feel about the Declan Wynn situation, and I think the reality is Danny Wilson even playing at this point, let alone on the bench, if Axel Schuberg doesn't have a concussion and Courtney Ford isn't nursing an injury? So I don't know what to make of this backline right now, and I still don't know how they fixed them, and I'm not sure how I feel about the Rapids just saying, okay, we're just going to have to win every game 3-2 in order to be successful in the second half of the season. That is, all of that collectively is not a recipe for success.
Yeah, I mean, it in my head, the right answer to this problem is a center back three of Tommy Smith in the middle, Courtney Ford as your right center back, and somebody that Porik buys who's a really, really good buy as your left center back. That's the proper solution right now, and I'm not sure whether that's what they're working on. I think a lot of people want to see Axel in the middle. I don't think that's a bad idea, but I actually, you know, to be very honest, in the games that Axel has played, he's been fine, but he hasn't been great. And that might be that foot speed matters in this system, and it might be that, he hasn't really had a full run out of games, like four games in a row. And now he's got his concussion, and I don't know how far along he is on recovery from that. And concussions are really difficult to figure out. So, and then the team went and made a, in my humble opinion, stupid move of getting rid of Eric Miller and deciding that he wasn't whatever they wanted to be at center back. So we don't have a lot of options at center back, you know, that we can turn to. I think Porik Smith brings somebody in as your third option, and I think theoretically that Declan Wynn and Danny Wilson should be on the bench. I don't know that Anthony Hudson feels that way. I feel like Anthony Hudson, his depth chart permanently is Smith, Wynn, and Wilson, even if the other guys get back. I don't know. I don't know if that's true, but it feels that way.
I'm not sure, Mark. We'll talk about this a little bit later, but just quickly to recap Minnesota United, and then we'll move on to the Whitecaps of Vancouver. What was your big thing from this game, Mark?
You know, 3 points. The confidence builder moving forward, the idea that, one last thing, I guess, is a couple games ago I wrote that if we don't turn it around and over the stretch of the next 5 games in which we play a lot of bad teams, we played Minnesota, we played Vancouver, we played Chicago, we play Seattle at home on July 4th, and then there's a fifth team that I'm forgetting right now. Maybe you remember it. But I said we should take 9 points from these 5 games or we're in bad shape. We have 4 right now, which means that in the next 3 games, if we can get another win and another tie, I wouldn't say we're, like, looking good or bouncing back or, you know, but we're definitely back in the position of making people in MLS say, could they sneak back into the playoff race? You know, like, at this point, trying to get yourself to 8th position is a laudable goal, because of the way the West is this year, you can kind of, like, scum along at the bottom for a little while and maybe pull a Seattle still. So that said, don't misread me, Rapids fans. You know, taking 4 points from the next 3 games is still not a given. It's not an easy thing to do. I think we can beat Seattle because everybody beats Seattle right now. Vancouver is going to be a tough one, and I have to go look up who that last game is. Matt, what's your big thing?
The shenanigans in the 77th minute. Joe Mason scores on the goal, and then Danny Wilson and Miguel Ibarra are both going back to get the ball. I don't really understand that, because if you're talking from the Minnesota standpoint, do you really think that now that you're entering the 80th minute, you're playing at altitude, you had to play midweek, that you're gonna go and try and get a second goal? I think at that point, you try to, you know, you maybe park the bus and try and CONCACAF your way to a 2-2 draw and say, we played well, we did some bad things, we could have done some things better. And then you look at, obviously, Danny Wilson's trying to get the ball back to the center circle because it's, okay, we just tied the game up. We've got a sub left over, if I'm not mistaken. Let's go try and get this win, so to speak. So I don't understand Miguel Ibarra's obsession with trying to get the ball to get the game restarted. And independent of all of that, of the scuffle of, okay, who's going to get the ball, you know, his response was completely unwarranted. You know, everybody, you know, I get the Google alerts, and obviously all of the local media was saying, you know, Tommy Smith scores a goal in stoppage time to end the winless streak for the Colorado Rapids. I think, you know, I'm writing more for the general audience of implying that they're going to be Minnesota United fans potentially looking at my work and seeing what I'm writing on Twitter. I think the real story was here is that in the first 75 minutes of the game, Miguel Ibarra was the man of the match. He was living up to the Batman legacy, and then he immediately went full Joker and chaotic evil and completely lost his mind. And he tries to punch Danny Wilson in the back of the head. He shoves him over in the process, and then you've just got this mass confrontation at that point, and, you know, the refs have to circle it out and everything. They talked about it a lot on Instant Replay. Loons fans are crying foul that, you know, if Miguel Ibarra is getting, you know, the red card for, you know, hands to the face and, you know, his kind of back punch, kind of not completely clenched fist to Danny Wilson's head, shouldn't Jack Price, you know, get a red card for what, you know, Andrew Wiebe on Extra Time Radio was calling, you know, the monkey with the cymbals clap, almost, so to speak. But, you know, to my hand, you know, that was, I don't remember what the actual language at the end of the rule was, but it was basically saying, aside from negligible contact, you know, if I wipe my nose, for example, and my elbow grazes your earlobe, that doesn't count as hands to the face, so to speak. And then even if you're going to say that, Miguel Ibarra started that whole thing. Okay, you were fighting for the ball, whatever. You know, I just, the advice I'd give to every single soccer player is if you just stick to, like, open hand shoving, back, side, or front, from, like, elbow to belly button, you're fine. You go anywhere low, you are at risk of getting carded. You do anything above the shoulders, you're risk coming hand with the face, and MLS is clearly trying to crack down on hands of the face, you're gonna get a straight red card. Miguel Ibarra didn't need to react the way that he did. Even if he was going to react and do something remotely violent or at the very least chippy, he could have gone about in a way to not put himself in that situation, and I'm in no way going to criticize as, you know, from a fan perspective, from a media perspective, or even if I was a member of the club, Jack Price or somebody else coming in to try and defend their player who openly is getting jumped by an opponent, so to speak. Yep. So I don't know what to make sense of that. I don't know what was going on in Miguel Ibarra's head. I completely agree with the red card. And then MLS, pro came out with a statement warning both clubs about mass confrontation. There were at least five players from both teams discussing with the ref as the VAR review was going under. You know, mass confrontation is something we need to address. Harris Madunian and losing his mind aside. So I didn't know what to make of that situation. That was absolutely crazy. And I felt it was completely unwarranted given the circumstances and completely avoidable. And it's just that sequence has no place in soccer. And I really hope that we never have to talk about something like this again in the context of the Colorado Rapids.
How many games do you think Miguel Ibarra gets suspended? 1, 2, 3, 4.
I wouldn't think he gets, well, the red card is definitely going to stand, so there's no way he's not missing at least one. I wouldn't be shocked if he gets a second, just given the way that he sort of went about instigating it. I personally wouldn't complain from an objectivity standpoint if he only got one. I definitely don't think that he deserves three, and I think Loons fans would be valid in complaining if he got an extra two-game ban, on top of his red card suspension.
I think if Yannick Bolli gets 2 games suspended, then I think Miguel Ibarra gets 2 games suspended. I even think that you could make an argument that if Yannick Bolli gets 2 for what was more or less an unintentional but stupid swing of his arm behind him that connected with an opponent's face, then Ibarra, who intentionally went after the back of a guy's head, should get 3 games. That would be logical to me. That being said, I don't think Volley should have gotten 2, so I think Ibarra should get 2.
I agree with all of your standpoints on there, Mark. Okay, Mark, moving on. This Sunday at BC Place, the Colorado Rapids will take on the Vancouver Whitecaps. Mark, we are currently 15-34th way through the regular season for the Rapids. They are 3-9-3, good for 12 points, and tied, well, I guess 11th in the Western Conference, behind Seattle on goal differential. They are taking on the Vancouver Whitecaps, who have played 17 games. They are 6-6-5 on the season, 3-1-4 at home, good for 23 points, and they have the last spot in the Western Conference playoff race right now. We did preview them for the game back on June 1st, folks, so I won't spend a whole lot of time going over their roster, talking about who Christian Teixeira is, talking about Alphonso Davies. If you don't know who Alphonso Davies is, I don't know how you're listening to this podcast, because there's no way you're an MLS nerd enough to know about him. But in any case, Mark, the Whitecaps have had a very, very slow month of June. They've only played 2 games since playing the Rapids back on June 1st. They got a big 5-2 win against a really disorganized Orlando City SC team. That ended up being the nail in the coffin for Orlando City head coach Jason Kreis. And then this past Friday, they played at Philadelphia Union and got absolutely blasted by a score of 4-0. They had 2 red cards in this game. Jose Aja was sent off. Yordi Reyna was given a second yellow card in stoppage time as well. The Vancouver Whitecaps are not playing well. As we were talking before recording, Mark, they're a little bit of a bogey team where you could see them come out and score a bunch of goals, or like they either get blown out or they blow the opponent out. They don't have a whole lot of 1-0 games. Mark, what do you make of the Vancouver Whitecaps in their run of form, and what form of team are we going to see against the Rapids on Sunday?
1 second, right before I answer that, I wanted to tell you guys what the 5th game was that I forgot, which is we play Montreal on the road. So that's that 5th game that's a winnable game where I thought like we could get, you know, at least 4 points from the next 9 games. Okay. Yeah, they're a good team, except when they're a terrible team. You know, when they ran roughshod over Orlando City 5-2, I think Alphonso Davies had a hat trick in that one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where he had 2 goals and 2 assists or something obscene like that. He was everywhere and all over the place. And he does this thing that the Rapids saw when they lost to Vancouver 2-1 on June 2nd, which is, he gets loose in transition in open space and open field and just destroys you. And so if you let Alphonso Davies, I can't even remember his name. It's Orlando, it's Alphonso, it's Antonio, it's Roberto. if you let Davies get loose on you, the 18-year-old will destroy you. So don't let him do that. Hopefully they know that. My guess is that they either have Enzo Martinez or Jack Price essentially man-marking him, or they are kind of shading him. Maybe not watching him, like man for man, but staying close to his side and being careful. So that's one thing that I would watch for. That, you know, when we have our 5-3-2 setup, sometimes it's more like we have 2 sixes and a 10, and sometimes it's more like we have a 6, an 8, and a 10. I would say that we've been very attacking most of the season. You don't see the Rapids sit with 2 sixes very often, but sometimes you'll see both Price and Enzo Martinez kind of shield the back line by, especially when the 2 wingbacks are pushed up the field. So essentially you have 5 defenders and they're playing extremely close and protecting the middle, and we're conceding the wings. If I were game planning this for the Colorado Rapids staff, I would concede the wings as much as possible and play tight so that your 3 center backs and your 2 defensive midfielders are playing basically the width of the 18-yard box, and you're letting the wings go and you're attacking with your wings. The challenge with that when you're an attacking team is that when you concede the wings, it usually means that you're attacking down the wings, because that's why you're conceding. You're using your wingbacks to provide width and to provide attack, which against Vancouver can mean that we're bending in crosses, which is never particularly fun, and it's not a high percentage shot. So that's a little kind of tactics about it. You know, Vancouver likes to change their formation. They like to come out and be a little bit of a guessing game. And they, like I said, like you were saying, Matt, they're live by the sword, die by the sword. They either want to score a lot of goals while conceding a lot of goals. They've been uneven. You know, they had four games in a row in the month of May in which they tied. Those scores were 2-2, 2-2, 2-2, and 3-3. That's insane. You barely ever see soccer teams, two teams together put up four goals, let alone do it 3 weeks in a row and then cap it off with scoring a collective six goals. So it's kind of insane. You know, they haven't been involved in a 1-0 nail biter since May 5th, and they've only had, two games in which there was one goal or fewer scored by both teams. They're just high octane, you know, chaos reigns, like total madness. But they're also, you know, they have a lot of really questionable players. You know, Bolaños will be coming back from playing with Costa Rica, right?
Bolaños, I thought, Kendall Waston's with Costa Rica. And Bolaños as well. So they play their last game. So those are two players who play for the Whitecaps, folks, who are with Costa Rica, the Ticos, right now at the World Cup. So they've missed their, the last two games for their club team. So, Costa Rica's last game is against Switzerland. That is tomorrow at noon. So Wednesday at noon. By the time you're listening to this, that game's probably already kicked off or possibly already over. Costa Rica's already out. They lost their first two games and they're not going to do anything against Switzerland, if you ask me, Mark. I'm assuming that's a noon game here, which I believe is a 9 o'clock kickoff, Moscow, St. Petersburg time zone. There's no way they're flying out tonight. They're probably flying out sometime tomorrow. When you account for the time zone change and everything, there's no way they're getting back before Friday, which means their first night sleep back in Vancouver is probably sometime in the middle on Saturday with all of the time zone change and everything. Physically, they might be available for selection, but I really, really doubt that Carl Robinson is going to throw either of them out, given what they've just gone through and everything, and just all of the travel, all things considered. You know, we complain about, you know, having to go on a 3 or 4 hour plane ride that involves two, you know, time zone shifts, let alone having to travel a total of 12 hours and having to go halfway across the world. I assume that they could be available for selection. I highly doubt either of them play Sunday.
Yep. Okay. Yeah, so they've got Marco Ureña, who plays for LAFC, and also Kendall Waston, and Christian Bolaños is also with Costa Rica. So it's a bit of a challenge for them, but we'll see. We'll see.
Okay, I guess the one thing that I would add here, Mark, is, you know, this is kind of the Rapids are okay with the opponent having the ball, as we've seen, and obviously Vancouver, the one thing that they don't want is the ball. You know, it's almost, you know, it's like they're setting a trap like Velociraptors, almost, where it's like, we'll give you the ball, so to speak, so that we can spring on you and then claw your face off and eat your flesh, so to speak. So I would almost be okay with the Rapids maybe coming out with two committed sixes in this game, specifically to try and cut down on those counterattack opportunities. Whether that's Enzo Martinez, I'd be okay with giving Michael Azira a shout at to potentially start or come off the bench in this game, so to speak. He's very familiar with Vancouver, given all the time that he spent with the Seattle Sounders. And maybe just, you know, try and cut down, you know, like we were talking about, where Schuler gets the ball off of the turnover, and Jack Price needs to make that run to sort of, you know, put out the fire before it starts. I feel like the key there for both teams is trying to prevent that, because it's almost kind of it's a cat and mouse game where as soon as you blink, the other team is off to the races, and I'm really curious to see what that looks like. I guess the only other thing that I throw out in there, Mark, you know, similar to what you said about Alphonso Davies, is, you know, do the Rapids maybe sort of, you know, have that wing back, concede that side, and then attack on the other side? Alphonso Davies has been mostly as a left midfielder, so that would be the Rapids right side, so the Marlon Harrison, Declan Wynn side of the field. Do they maybe concede that and just say, okay, we'll give you that side of the field, we're going to go through Edgar Castillo, especially given the couple of games that Edgar's had? I'm really curious to see what that looks like and how the Rapids try and balance that, given what happened to them on June 1st at Dick's Sporting Goods Park, and given that this will be their first game at BC Place this season.
Yeah, Yeah, the last thing to worry about with this team is, of course, Kai Kumara, who is going to be likely up top as long as he's healthy. And Kumara is, you know, a handful to deal with. He elevates. He's already a big, tall guy in MLS. He's strong. And he elevates typically better and bigger and with better timing than almost anybody else. He's lost a step or two from his Columbus days. You know, and he's two teams removed from them, but Kai Kumara is always a problem. So if you can bend the ball into him, or if you feel like if he pulls you away, then it creates, mismatch problems underneath for a guy like, Alphonso Davies. So, you know, this team has weapons. One of their weapons, which is kind of a misfiring gun that can shoot them in the foot, is Breck Shea, who has played in every position for them, but he's also made a really terrible mistake in front of goal where he completely biffed a wide open net earlier in the season, if you didn't see that highlight or low light. And he's also been slotted in at left back and been really terrible at times. So, you know, Breck Shea is kind of like an amazing player in that, like, you know, he came back to Orlando City from abroad, and he was in the U.S. men's national team kind of set up in, like, 2015.
Scored the championship-winning goal at the 2013 Gold Cup, I believe. Yeah,
but he's really fallen off. Like, I don't think anybody in their right mind thinks Breck Shea is going to be back on any U.S. MNTs in the future. And I think a lot of teams are starting to think, I think, you know, at the end of this season, it's probably if he doesn't really start to show improvement. I mean, what Breck Shea is incredibly fast in the open field. But anything short of that that you ask him to do, like shoot, defend, or pass, is a open question. So it's a fascinating thing, you know? If I were the Rapids, I'd wait for Breck Shea to make a really stupid move and then drive right behind where he just left, or just drive right at him and watch if he defends. But that assumes that he starts, and usually he comes off the bench in the 75th to provide a spark. They're not really using him as a starter. But if they have all the injuries that they have, all the red cards that they have, plus the international guys who are not going to be back, then you might expect Breck Shea to be in the starting lineup, and, you know, that might be fun for Colorado.
Absolutely, Mark. Let's move on. Mark, I was at training earlier today, the Rapids' first training session off of their win on Saturday, and we've got a bunch of good news on the injury front, Mark. I think we might actually be heading to the point where, for the first time, I want to say this entire season, going into a match day on Sunday, the Rapids will, in theory, have every single player on roster in Commerce City. Well, I guess on roster in Commerce City going to Vancouver, British Columbia, will be eligible to play. Johan Blomgren kind of aggravated something a little bit earlier last week, but he's fine. The next big test for him is seeing whether or not he can go 90 minutes, according to Anthony Hudson. Joe Mason, who came off the bench, he's totally fine now. You know, he's had a couple of little niggles here and there, but his hamstring is fine at this point. The next thing for him as far as getting back to fitness is more minutes, so coming off the bench a little bit earlier, possibly even starting a game, depending on how things look. Marlon Hairston is okay as well. No concussion symptoms whatsoever for him. No concussion protocol, whatever, with him. It was a very precautionary scare that led to him getting subbed out for, I believe, Enzo Martinez. Correct me if I'm wrong there, Mark, on Saturday. Okay, I believe it was Enzo Martinez. Don't quote me there because I don't have that stat in front of me, but he's totally okay. He was there training today. And then Courtney Ford is expected to be, was fully in training last week, is fully in training this week. I would anticipate that he would also be eligible for selection. And then this is kind of a little bit of a foregone conclusion here. Axel was on the bench on Saturday night, so he's cleared everything as far as concussion protocol, so he is obviously eligible for selection. So, Mark, I think for the first time, Anthony Hudson can't go into a game saying that, oh, we've got a bunch of injuries, because he actually has everybody back.
Woohoo!
Okay. Yes, and then I've got two other things to kind of talk about here, folks. Pretty regularly, this is the inside baseball side of holding the high line. You see the Rapids with all of their build-up, with either their build-up exercises, their scrimmages, either 11v11 on a full field or 7v7 on a smaller field. Pretty typically, you've seen all of the starters coming together, playing on the same team, and then the reserves are kind of a hodgepodge depending on what the training session of the day is going to look like. This is the first session that I've been on for its entirety, Mark. It was about 2 hours today, in which you saw regular rotating of the cast. So you saw multiple instances where Axel was in the middle alongside Tommy Smith and Declan Wynn, and then also Danny Wilson was there at times. You saw Marlon Harrison and Nana Boateng both playing at center midfield, or at right wing back, excuse me. You had every single one of the forwards involved in there. Nicky Jackson, I thought, had a really, really good training session. I know there was a little bit of concern with him a couple of weeks ago, so as opposed to kind of having the designated, where we have the starters, we're going to have the starters play together, there was a lot more rotating of the cast. Based on me connecting some of the dots, and also Anthony Hudson providing some of those dots and some of those connections, but not everything. Obviously, the Rapids have a busy schedule coming up. They're not traveling to Vancouver until Saturday. They'll travel back after the game on Sunday, and then they've got Monday, Tuesday, and then the game against Seattle. So potentially, he's experimenting with lineups to do a little bit of roster rotation between those two games. He also alluded to that for the first time, really, they're at the start of having a healthy bench to where they can have healthy competition 4 minutes in training, to where you can actually have competitions, not, oh, well, we've got three injured strikers, so this is who we're going with, sort of a thing. So I think they're actually having an experimentation and then actually dealing with who's actually developing relationships with who. That could dictate maybe who starts or comes off the bench in any of the games with the rotation that they have due to the congested schedule coming up over the course of the next 10 days, next week or so, excuse me, and that also could be leading to having healthy competition to where, you know, maybe if Axel ends up being the best center back in training, maybe he's in the lineup, so to speak. If Sam Nicholson's doing a really, really good job, then maybe he starts. You know, if Joe Mason is doing really well and, you know, maybe nutmegs Yannick Bolli, maybe he starts over Bolli. Bolli obviously suspended for this Sunday, so that's not really relevant. But this is the first time really that I've noticed, Mark, that the Rapids don't maybe, you know, have a bare minimum squad, if they can actually have a full squad rotation and competition, and, you know, have guys legitimately having to compete, not knowing who's starting on Sunday or who's potentially going to be eligible for selection on Wednesday for 4th of July against the Sounders.
Yep.
Okay.
That's a lot of good inside info, Matt.
Yeah, and then one other thing, I teased it a little bit when we were recapping the Vancouver game, Mark. I've noticed the Rapids over the course of the last couple weeks, and today especially, were working on their build-up play against the press really, really well, and making sure that they weren't making any mistakes. And usually if something ends up going wrong, Anthony Hudson or one of the other coaches will stop the build-up exercise partway through. There'll usually be a teaching moment, possibly a couple of sentences that have four little words that would be bleached potentially, and then that group gets kicked out, and then the second group gets to run the exercise until either they complete it or they mess it up, so to speak. And usually that takes until they get into the midfield at some point for the mistake to happen. But I thought the execution was really, really good today in terms of actually getting to the strikers and then it leading to a play out wide and then across into the box with numbers. And just the execution on an individual basis and on a collective basis was excellent. And one of the plays that I've seen them work on that in the last 2 weeks they've done a really, really good job with. It was really good today and really good on Saturday. Can you see where I'm going here, Mark?
Sorta.
Okay. Do you want to take a guess on what play I'm potentially alluding to?
Center backs up the middle.
A center back going up the middle, distributing the ball, and then continuing their run with the object of occupying that outside wide player on either one end of the field or the other. You go back and watch the Edgar Castillo goal on Saturday, folks. Declan Wynn has a pass very, very early in the buildup. Tommy Smith pushes up a little bit to overload the midfield and then eventually sets up the play. Declan Wynn is running from the other side of the field the entire point, and then the outside back for Minnesota, I can't remember his name, I want to say it was Voxel, but I can't remember his name, as soon as Enzo Martinez crosses the field there. That is when Declan Wynn is making his run. He makes a little bit of a hand motion to Edgar Castillo in order to play the ball. He keeps running to occupy the fullback. That completely leaves that hole in that near side corner of the box completely open. Edgar Castillo takes a touch to cut inside and then curls the ball. He runs directly, you see on the replay from the goal mark, he runs all the way across to the benches and sort of jump hug wraparound tackles Neil Emblem, one of the assistant coaches who's been the main coach in running those drills and exerciting their various formations and the build-up sequences that they have. I am 90% sure, Mark, that that play on Saturday was a set play. They knew what they were doing off of the ball coming back into play. They executed it to a T, and they're doing it a lot better in general on the training pitch and during games.
Yeah, I like the way in that play that Enzo laid just a really slick, perfect weighted ball to the left side. And I like the idea, and I could be wrong about this, but I think I'm right, that when the center back makes that pass and then continues their run, it's kind of like an option play in throw ball, where if the center back of the opposing team commits to tracking the run by Declan Wynn, he's pulled off out of position and the line has to compensate, which allows someone like Edgar Castillo to cut into some open space that wasn't there before because the center back has moved over to fill. And if the center back decides not to go to the center back who's running through, then potentially either Enzo Martinez or Edgar Castillo has a 1-2 touch pass to lay in to the center back who's breaking through the line. So the ball's played from like middle, wide, and then pinged back into middle. So on some level what I'm saying is, Matt, you could say it totally, if anybody from the technical staff of Vancouver is listening, it would suck because they would see this coming and, you know, they would hear this podcast and our breakdown of it and would know, oh man, Rabbi and Red have been watching this team all year. They see this. We've got to plan and stop it because the two best podcast commentators in the Colorado Rapids have really, you know, exposed an important aspect to it. But the other way to look at this is it's like how, unfortunately, he's not at the World Cup. How the Dutch right wide attacker for Bayern Munich, whose name escapes me right now. Matt, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh my God, yeah, I have his face. I love this guy too. Like, I want him to be a DP in MLS sometime, but I can't remember his name.
The bald dude.
Yes.
Yeah, well, everybody knows that he's a left-footed right-wide midfielder, and he's going to cut in on his left foot, and you don't know when it's going to happen, and you can't stop it, and there's nothing you can do about it. So that's just how it is. It's kind of that. The Rapids have a situation where they may have created a series of offensive plays where you might see it coming, but you can't really stop it because it has multiple options. So I don't know. That'd be really fun if that works out that way. The other flip side of that is, we don't make it work, and they expose us on the counter while our center back's not there.
Absolutely, Mark. The player we were both thinking of, Iron Robin.
Iron Robin, oh, he's so good. And the fact that I forgot his name breaks my heart.
Yes, right. Iron Robin, and you listening to this podcast, we apologize. We are not we're not idiots about soccer most of the time. Moving on, Mark.
I am convinced Iron Robin does not listen to this podcast. I'm also convinced that Vancouver's technical staff doesn't either.
Okay.
But that's okay. Maybe they do.
Moving on, Mark, speaking of moving on to people who do listen to our podcast, it is time for hashtag AskHTHL, and we'll start, Mark, with, I think, the first, I didn't know that host AskHTHLs were possible, but you had one this week regarding fan voting, and in particular, Atlanta United fans regarding the All-Star Fan 11 for the MLS All-Star game coming up, surprisingly, in Atlanta. Mark, go ahead and rant.
Yeah, so the All-Star game is kind of broken, and it always has been. There's no way around this. This year might be the most broken it's ever been. Here is the starting 11 that the fans voted. One of these positions is taken because of this really cool thing that I like, which is also kind of stupid, which is for a certain amount of weeks, EA Sports counts up how many goals are scored by MLS players, and the guy who scores the most goals gets to go to the All-Star game.
This is in FIFA, the video game, folks. So you select the Rapids, you score a bunch of goals with Dominic Baggi. Dominic Baggi is the EA Sports More Than a Vote Challenge winner, and he gets to go to the MLS All-Star game. Continue.
And by the way, I think I scored 15 goals with Dom Baggi, so I think he should go. But apparently I was outvoted by the people who picked Carlos Vela, because according to EA Sports, Carlos Vela scored 2 million goals in this time period. Literally, I'm not exaggerating.
That seems implausible.
No,
that seems like a lot.
There's a lot of people. Well, so someone pointed this out to me, and I didn't think about it, but I should have, which is because I don't know if you guys play a lot of FIFA. If you play a lot of FIFA, Zlatan Ibrahimovic has a 90 rated player on FIFA out of 100 or out of 99, which is the highest in MLS. And there's something really hinky up with Alessandrini. Alessandrini has two cards, an 82 and an 84, and they're both ridiculously good. I have scored 60 goals with Alessandrini. He's my leading scorer of anybody on my FIFA team. But it doesn't matter, because Carlos Vela plays for the Mexican national team, and if you play a lot of FIFA, you know that everybody online loves their Mexican national team players. I play so many L-tree wannabe guys online, it's kind of amazing. So let me give you the other 10 players that are picked. Brad Guzan, Michael Parkhurst, Lawrence Simon, Graham Zusi, Miguel Almiron, Ezequiel Barco, Darlington Nagbe, Diego Valeri, Joseph Martinez, and Zlatan Ibrahimovic. Matt, how many of those players plays for Atlanta United?
That would be 6. So 6 yeah. out of 10 as far as the fan voting, 6 out of 11 overall.
6 out of 10 votable people. And we all know what the reason is for that, which is that Atlanta is selling out a massive stadium with between 40 and 70,000 people every single game. They've built this amazing fan culture. They have a tremendous number of fans. Their fans are super engaged, and they also have a lot of talented players. Does Darlington Nagbe really deserve to be at the All-Star game? Does Michael Parkhurst? Does Brad Guzan? Is he really the best goalkeeper? I mean, you know, it's not hard to make a case for Joseph Martinez. It's not hard to make a case for Miguel Almiron. It's a little harder for the rest of the team. And what that says is, and we know this from a year and 2 years ago when Toronto and when Seattle were dominating this, that it's really more about fan engagement and the number of fans you have than it is about how good your players are. The same holds true, Matt, and you know this, from Goal of the Week, right?
Yep.
And Save of the Week. If Tim Howard makes the world's greatest save, if he has a Belgium-like performance, and Stefan Fry is one of the 5 options for Save of the Week, Stefan Fry's winning. There's no way around it. Same with Brad Guzan. It's just the way it is right now, which means that the fan voting is broken. So my ask HCHL is essentially, I'll answer my own question, is the fan voting broken? The answer is yes. I'm fine with fans voting, but the way I would do it is like this. There are 11 starting positions. 3 of them should be determined by FIFA EA Sports. Maybe one of them the most goals scored, one of them the most games played, so that it allows like midfielders and defenders the option. And one of them, I don't know, some
saves
other
saves for the goalie, maybe?
Assists. You know, assists are a thing.
Assists would be a good one.
And then you give 3 spots to three starting spots to the fans, and you don't do it by overall most votes. You make it a forward, a midfielder, and a defender, and then you give the players 3 spots: a forward, a midfielder, and a defender, and then you give the coach 1 spot in the starting 11, and then you come up with some other crazy way of coming up with the other, you know, 12 dudes on the roster. But like right now, the idea that, you know, the fans get to pick like that many positions, it's insane. It's just, it's broken. It's tragically, horrendously broken.
Couldn't agree with you more here, Mark. You know, I tweeted out my Fan 11 vote, actually, for the sake of transparency. You know, Zach Steffen and Tim Melia certainly deserve it over Brad Guzan. Ezekiel Barco's been hurt. He has 3 goals and 1 assist. You know what the great irony of here, Mark, is? Is after Joseph Martinez and Miguel Almiron, if you twisted my arm and made me have to pick another Atlanta United player to be an all-star, you know who that player would be for me?
Who's that?
Julian Gressel.
I would have gone with Gressel. I would have gone with Laurentiewicz. Laurentiewicz has been really strong in the middle. He's also redheaded, which is always a plus.
Yeah, so I mean, like, tell me that Julian Gressel doesn't make the 3-5-2 position work for Atlanta in the way that Edgar Castillo has been for the Rapids over the course of the last 3 or 4 games. You know, if you want to just go by the stats, for example, Ezekiel Barco, 3 goals, 1 assist. Julian Gressel, 2 goals, 5 assists. Who's the more valuable player in the terms of their production, so to speak? So I don't really get that. I don't think Darlington Nagbe deserves to be anywhere near this roster. I think it's going to be really, really funny to see the snickering that he and Diego Valeri have since they're both on the roster, but I agree with you that it's broken. The thing that I'll respond to that, Mark, is does anybody really care about the All-Star game? Mark, where was the All-Star game held last year?
Chicago.
Who'd they play?
It was last year.
Exactly. Nope. Real Madrid.
I don't know.
The fact that you didn't immediately remember that, you know. Like, the All-Star game doesn't really matter. It's a gimmick. It's a cash grab. It's a fun opportunity. It's a big deal if you're going to the All-Star game. It's a big deal if your team or your stadium or your city is hosting the All-Star game. I don't know that it's that a big deal other than getting recognition for one of your players who makes it, whether by fan vote or otherwise. So yes, is it broken, Mark? Would I like it to see it become a little bit more fair and a little bit more balanced and not due to fanboying and, you know, just the big cities with the big teams and the big budgets end up making it, so to speak? At the same time, what happened in the All-Star game last year in the first 15 minutes, Mark?
No idea.
Greg Garza got hurt. He came back later on in the season and immediately re-hurt his injury, and he's out for the rest of the year, so to speak. So, and Atlanta United fans want to make a big deal about hosting and want to have it. Great. Then, you know, have their players play a little bit, play more minutes. Maybe one of them gets hurt and it ends up hoping somebody else. I'm hoping that none of them get hurt, so to speak. But if you want to make a big deal about this thing, then you don't get to complain when it's, why do we have the All-Star game? Why are my players making more minutes? You brought this on yourself if somebody ends up getting hurt. You could have voted for somebody other than Joseph Martinez and Miguel Almiron. You could have voted for anybody else in the other 4 positions. So, you know, in that sense, I don't really care about this, so to speak, Mark. I'm probably barely going to watch the All-Star game. I agree it's broken. I would like to see them improve it. That said, I care way more about MLS's improvement in the engagement of VAR and taking the training wheels off of the CBA and doing more to create money on the budget and having the league not dictate to teams how they're allowed to spend their targeted allocation money.
Boom!
Okay, moving on, Mark, we have 2 other Ask HTHLs, and I will pull them up right now.
Are they email ones?
They are on Twitter. No emails this week. But if you would like to email us, folks, you can catch us at rapids96podcast@gmail.com or tweet us using the hashtag AskHTHL or tweet us at rapids96podcast. On the Twitter machine. So, Mark, we got an email within the first 2 minutes of the game kicking off on Saturday. This is from Epi Epperman at Anderson_01. I can't remember if this one had any profanity, but in any case, could someone please, all caps, explain to me why and how Jack McBean is starting with Mason and Gashi both on the bench? ! At this point, I feel I am simply throwing money away by coming to games. It's an embarrassing joke. Mark, why is Jack McBean starting in games so much this late in the season?
Well, some of Jack McBean's starts have had to do with injury, right?
Yes.
Bully not being fit. Mason had a couple games where he was hurt. Baji had that game where he was in the starting lineup and then tweaked a hamstring in warm-ups and came out and they threw in Jack McBean instead, right? Like, so there's been a lot of, like, hinky circumstances. That being said, there have been a couple games this season where Jack McBean was selected over Joe Mason. I think the idea is that he is a bigger physical presence, and if you want someone who can bring down a ball or who can head a ball, and you're going to use if you're going to use Dombaji, too many players with I at the end of their name, Boli, Gashi, anyways, if you're gonna have Jack McBean hold up the line that allows Dombaji to float in space and run at the back line with a little bit of pace, the problem that I've seen is that the Rapids often do it the other way around, where Baji's holding up the line and McBean's operating in space, and you're expecting him to beat some dude on the dribble.
Good luck with that.
Right, but you know, McBean is good at, if you're going to have the center back ping a long 40-yard ball up the field and have Bean kind of headed on to Baji, or Bean headed on to Enzo, or somebody else who's underneath, like Blomberg, he's a useful cog. He can do that pretty well. He can body up a man and leap pretty well. I have said something that I've never said before, which is a compliment to Jack McBean. I think it's very easy for Rapids Twitter and Rapids Facebook to get on Jack McBean and say he's a totally useless cog. My grandmother could do a better job. I don't think that's true. I just do think he's kind of a one-trick pony. He doesn't give you a lot of dimensions in soccer like a lot of the other forwards can. But my sense of and correct me if you disagree, but my sense of Mason is that he's not a physical presence, that you can kind of push him around, and so that if he's not running, if you're asking him to go mano a mano in the low post, he's not going to do it. Last thing I'll say is, somehow it doesn't seem like Gashi rates as the underneath striker, except in extra time. I think the sense is that he just doesn't have the ability to go for 90 minutes at a position like that that's so demanding. And also, back to my earlier point, Gashi really isn't a go up and head it in the midfield, you know, and go for hospital balls kind of guy. It's not his bag. Doesn't mean he's not tenacious. Doesn't mean he's not fearless. It just means he's not a big run and leap guy.
I agree with you, Mark. So a couple things here. Just addressing your point on Gashi, when I interviewed him for the podcast a couple of weeks ago now, and I asked him what his preferred position was, you know, because he's been in training, he's been out on the wing, he's been in the middle, he's kind of been all over the place, and sort of that front seven, if you're counting the wingbacks, the center mids, and the forwards. And he says the position that he fits in best based on his conversation with the coaching staff is center midfield, working as the most attacking player. So the number 10, or I guess the most forward number 8, so to speak, kind of in that what Johan Blomberg was in, say, the first month of the season. So I think that's pretty clear that, you know, despite the, you know, him being listed on the Colorado Rapids website as midfielder / forward, I think he's clearly a midfielder. He's clearly the more attacking one in that center midfield three. I'm going to go back to a point the last time we talked about Jack McBean that I think you made on the podcast, that was, you know, at this point in his career, Jack McBean is your run-of-the-mill, productive USL level striker. And if he's going to do anything in MLS, his numbers aren't going to be that good, or he's not going to get that many minutes. He's going to be riding the bench. He's going to be your midweek open cup guy. You know, somebody come off a bench, Lupman balls, you know, maybe play 500-700 minutes for a 34 game season, if he's lucky, so to speak. And there's nothing wrong with that. And there are plenty of players that, you know, there is a role that a guy like that can have on that roster, Mark. I personally am done with him starting. I wouldn't be starting him further, especially now that all the other strikers are going to get healthy, and after Sunday, you know, Yannick Bolli's suspension will be done. In the conversations I've had with Coach Hudson and in how I've seen him used, I agree with you in the sense that he's in there to do a particular job. He's probably the most physical forward that you have in terms of playing in the air, I'd say, other than Tommy Smith. He's probably the most physical aerial threat that you have on either side of the ball, or certainly on set pieces, offensive or defensive, so to speak. He's the closest that every team in Major League Soccer needs, that gritty number nine, rough up the game a little bit, create space for other players. You know, everybody, independent of what Alan Gordon's able to bring you in the final 10 minutes, everybody has a role for the skill sets that Alan Gordon has. And there are points and there are games in which you're going to need that person in order to be successful over the course of an MLS season. And Jack McBean's really the only piece that they have that can do that. You know, Boley and Baji are kind of cut from the same cloth, where they're really channel runny. You know, Joe Mason is kind of a dribbly poacher and get into space sort of a thing. He's the most underneath striker of the forwards that they have. Gashi's, you know, been moved to the midfield for the most part. Am I missing any other forwards? And then, you know, Nicky Jackson's in his first year and has kind of been back and forth with the Colorado Springs Switchbacks and is still kind of getting his feet under him in that sense. So if you're saying, with the way that I want to play, I need a pure number nine up top who's going to be able to battle for balls in the air, rough up the opponent for the first 70 minutes, create space for my channel runner, Dominic Baji, and then also tire out the opponent to the point where when I do get a more dribbly player in, that opponent is more tired to where they're not able to keep up with, or rough up that young player, or rough up that the substitute, in this case Joe Mason. So in that sense, you look at it, Jack McBean to a certain extent did a job where he wasn't really effective, but he softened up everybody else for the final 70 minutes that ultimately allowed the Rapids to be able to get results on the Minnesota United center backs because of what Jack McBean did. I don't know that starting him or having him play 70 minutes or be a regular in the squad is a recipe for success for the second half of the season or for long term. I don't know that he has a role or he's really going to be able to fit in as a regular in Major League Soccer for the extended period of time. You know, could he easily be a 12 goals, 5 assists kind of guy in USL over the course of their season next season? Absolutely, Mark. But, you know, I'm done with him personally, but given the way that Coach Hudson wants to play, Jack McBean's really the only puzzle piece that fits into that puzzle space.
Yep.
Moving on, Mark, we'll close out the show with our final Ask HTHL of the week. This comes from a regular, one of our good friends, Eugene Burke. He asks, I would love to hear your thoughts on how our defense can improve moving forward. In particular, we seem terrible at defending in transition and mental lapses still abound. ... Thoughts. Mark, you alluded to this a little bit earlier. How do we fix the defense? What sort of transfer moves are you looking at? How do we fix the mental lapses and the getting posterized as golden cones?
I don't know who the guy is, but I think you probably need an upgrade from Declan Wynn, especially if you're not sure when or if Courtney Ford is there to come back. I think Court also might be the guy who really takes a massive step forward with the back end of this year. The challenge, of course, is that very few players miss essentially half a season of soccer and turn it on and become instantly incredible. Axel Schoberg hasn't really, his 2017 started with a medial collateral ligament injury. And by the time he came back, he really never kind of clicked again. I don't know if it's a center back thing. I mean, Schuler at RSL is another example of that. Chris Schuler, a guy who was really talented, really highly touted. Kind of pushed him off. And so anyways, long story short, I feel like acquiring a really talented center back would be a good move. The front office of the Colorado Rapids has had a thing for going out and getting championship players who are sitting on the bench for teams like Wolverhampton, and I don't really love the idea that, you know, there's gold in them thar hills with players who aren't getting starting minutes with their own teams. I've always liked a couple teams in Central America that are like Saprissa,
Olympiacos,
Municipal in Guatemala, teams that, you know, are regularly in CONCACAF Champions League that regularly churn out quality high-end players who wind up in MLS. You know, another way to go, which we have not done except for Edgar Castillo in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years with the Rapids, is trying to poach from Liga MX. And then one last sort, and I'm answering this in a different way, which is like, you know, what are avenues for MLS that we haven't seen a lot of? One place that I've always thought would be a really good place for MLS teams to go is the Russian League and Eastern Europe, especially when you're talking about minority players. Black and Latino players get treated awfully in the Russian League.
Yep.
And I think you could reasonably make an offer to somebody's agent and say, hey, I know you're playing for, you know,
Spartak,
CSKA Moscow, or Spartak, and they're making monkey noises at you in the corner and throwing bananas at you. What if we paid you $500,000 and nobody was allowed to be racist to you? What do you think about that? Like, I've always thought that would be an angle to play. I don't know how many really talented center backs there are in Russia right now who are subject to these kinds of things, but regardless, like, you know, as a transfer acquisition move, I've always thought we should really go to Russia and pick out players who aren't treated very well.
I agree with you there, Mark. I do think this team will be looking to make a move. You know, I think they'll be looking at both ends of the field, both, you know, attacking and defensive, but, you know, to address Eugene's question directly, I still think that Tommy Smith, in a vacuum as an individual, provides enough for you offensively going forward from the run of play and from set pieces to where you would really want to have him. You know, he has 2 goals in the last 2 games, which is nothing to scoff at, and he had a bunch of other chances in the first half of the season that, you know, I think certainly warrant him being a player in there. I would like to see Coach Hudson experiment a little bit more once Axel or, you know, Court are able to get, you know, a game or two or three into the run, so to speak. Fairly or unfairly, I think he still sees Declan Wynn as a 2018 pet project, not necessarily as a teacher or, I guess, a gaffer's pet, so to speak. So I'd like to see. So I think that he's going to go with that, whether or not it's fair or otherwise. I'd be curious to see how it works out, but I'm not sure how I feel about Declan Wynn in the long term at the MLS level. You know, I think they should be looking for other players on the international market. Mark, you know, as we've discussed ad nauseum, you know, they're, you know, any TAM that they're using at this point is going to be, you know, from Uncle Stan, as far as that's concerned. They do have the open DP slot. I am still very skeptical about using a DP slot on a goalkeeper or a defensive player, especially since there's, you know, there's a need for a number 10 on this team, so to speak. But one name that just popped into my head, I have no idea how much money he'd cost, and I don't think he'd leave, all things considered. But if you're looking for an American who's proven, who won't cost you an international slot, Tim Ream, for example, was just voted player of the year for Fulham, not for the championship, but just for the club, for Fulham, so to speak. That said, they just got promoted, and he's still under contract. I'd assume if Fulham's giving him up, they're going to want a significant transfer fee. And how much money does Tim Ream want, you know, when he's going to start getting some of that Premier League, you know, 150 country TV money, so to speak. But, you know, the Rapids don't have an open international slot. There's not a whole lot of a market for moving international roster spots. You know, I think New England has 3 right now that they're not using. What's Brad Friedel thinking, you know, out at Gillette Stadium in Foxborough? And are they potentially willing to move that? How much money is that going to cost in terms of assets that you're looking at in order to try and get another international player? And then you're just increasing the number of international roster spots the team's going to need potentially next year and going forward. So the market's a little bit tight. I think they're going to have to get a little bit creative, but Porrick Smith has already been really creative in some of the moves that he's made, and it's allowed them to, as Hudson's referred to it, create money on the budget. They're talking daily, and I think they're going to pursue some of their assets. They're going to try and do something. I don't know if it's going to work, and I don't know how much time or what they're going to have to give up in order to get it. I do think that they need to make a move. I'm not sure how they do it, but I think there's a lot internally that they can still improve upon, either in Hudson having more time to try and get Declan to work, so to speak, or working in one of the other center backs, or, as I've talked ad nauseum on this show, fixing things in the midfield such that that doesn't create the T-Rex chase ripple effects that ultimately lead to Danny Wilson getting posterized at the back, so to speak. So I think, Eugene, I think there are a number of ways for the Rapids to improve internally, both with their current back line, with the rest of the squad to improve the defense in general. You know, it's a mentality and it's a focus thing as far as the mental issues. I don't know with the current squad that they have right now, you know, Danny Wilson and Tommy Smith are both in their late 20s. I think Declan Wynn's 25. You don't see players gain speed after the age of 26, so I don't think they can get a little bit faster. I do think that they can make improvements even with their current personnel to where they're not put into those situations. I think that's going to be probably the biggest thing for the Rapids to improve on in the second half of the season. Any other closing thoughts, or should we get out of here, Mark?
Let's get the heck out of here.
Listeners, you can follow us individually on Twitter at RapidsRabbi and at LWS Matt Pollard. You can follow us collectively on Twitter at Rapids96Podcast on Twitter. You can email the show at Rapids96Podcast@gmail.com or tweet us with your hashtags AskHTHL. Subscribe to us wherever you get your podcast. We're on pretty much everything that's relevant. Still working with Blueberry to try to get on Spotify. Hopefully that gets resolved sometime in July. But after that, if you can't find our podcast, you're probably sending us AskHTHLs by a carrier pigeon, in which case my window isn't open and I don't really want a whole lot of bird poop on my balcony, so to speak. Listeners, we'll see you next week.